Thank you, Frank, and thank you to all of you for that nice welcome. My name is Mitchell Savage, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really grateful to be here with you tonight. I'm thrilled to be here. The first reason I'm really glad to be here is because I was thinking about this all day long. Since everyone has been so wonderful since I've gotten here, everyone has helped to make me feel so welcome. And I don't know about you, but I just haven't always had it this good. I have not always, I haven't always looked like this. I haven't always smelled like this. And I have not always been surrounded by people that want the best for me. And so to be here with you tonight is a real privilege and a real thrill. And I want to thank everyone that was responsible for helping to get me here. It's already been a blessing. And then the other reason that I'm glad to be here is because I can't wait to find out what I'm going to say tonight. I had such a week. You can't believe the week I had. Oh, my God. Does anybody feel sorry for me yet? No. Bunch of Al-Anons. God. Where am I? Before the meeting, and I also was surprised. I'm a long way from home right now, so I was surprised to see so many people that I know here. I saw my friend Don from Los Angeles, and he introduced me to his friend Beverly, who's very nice, and helped me. She helped me get ready for the meeting. She came up to me and said, "Are you nervous?" And I said, "No," because I wasn't, you know. And she said, "Well, if you're not nervous, that means you're not going to make a good talk." And I don't know if this counts or not, but that made me real nervous. And there's other people here that I've seen that I've met at other conventions. It's just a thrill to have this chance to get back together and see where people have been. And I'm moved and thrilled to be part of this. So thank you for including me in your program. I have the unenviable task tonight of trying to tell you something that I really think defies description, to try to tell you what it's like to have been an Alcoholics Anonymous this 15 years and describe to you what I was like and what happened and what I'm like now. It's really quite impossible because so much time has gone by and really at the root of all of this is a thing that I think defies description anyway. I believe that the reason that I am sober today is because of a thing called grace. And grace, I think, is the experience of a power greater than myself. That regardless of what has gone on in the past, stands ready at any time to give me every good thing that I need. And I can't tell you what that feels like. Until you've experienced it, until you've come to believe that this power exists for you and that this power is ready to do for you what you need done, then I cannot describe to you with any words that I am aware of what it feels like to know that God knows my address and is as close to me as my breath and is with me now. But I can tell you that I feel it. And I didn't feel it when I got here. And what they told me was, if you will do some things to make yourself ready to receive this gift, we promise you this will work for you. And that's all I've done for the last 15 years is use the tools that you've given me to try to make myself ready to receive this thing that our book describes as a spiritual awakening or a spiritual experience. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1984, I never intended to stay this long. I wanted to get the heat off, but I didn't really think that I really needed to be here. In 1984, I had a really serious problem before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. My problem was that I was suffering from alcoholism, a malady, as our book calls it, and I didn't know it. Now, I have today in my body all the physiological aspects of the illness of alcoholism that I had back then. But something is different now. And the thing that's different now is, of course, I haven't put a drink in my body today. But something else that makes it different now is that I know it. You've made me aware of what's wrong with me. And so on a daily basis, one day at a time, I don't have to treat myself the way that I used to. But back in 1984, I was suffering from this illness of alcoholism and didn't know it. And I have a picture in my head of what it was like back then. And I hope that I never forget this picture because I think that as long as I remember it, I probably won't have to go back to it if I do the things that you've asked me to do. But in 1984, I was living in Norman, Oklahoma. And I lived in a little house that really had the potential of being a pretty nice house. Its main problem was that I lived there. And maybe you've seen one of these houses where the weeds are grown up halfway the height of the house and are like coming in the window. And if it was dark outside, it was dark inside because there was no electricity. And if it was hot outside, it was hot inside because there was no air conditioning. If it was cold outside, it was cold inside because there was no natural gas. And if you would have come in that house at that time, you would have smelled me. Because there's no running water, and so you couldn't wash yourself. And in the middle of that living room was this long yellow couch, and we all have our long yellow couches. And there was a long yellow couch in this living room, and in this living room, the furniture and the drapes and the carpets were covered in blood and puke and urine, and I used to lay on that long yellow couch and hang my head off the side of the couch backwards and spray hairspray on the roof of my mouth to let the alcohol trickle down my throat and just kind of soak. And you can get a buzz that way if your stomach is shot, and mine was. So I didn't bother to drink, because anything that I drank just came right back out. And so it was just a waste of perfectly good alcohol as far as I could tell. And if your stomach is that shot and you can't use your stomach to get the buzz that you need, if you're as creative as what I was, then you put alcohol on the soft tissues in your throat and in your mouth and on your gums. And I used to use an eyedropper, and I would fill it with vanilla extract and hold my eye down like this and put vanilla extract in my eyes to get alcohol on the blood vessels and the soft tissues in my eyes. And I can remember thinking that I could quit any time I wanted to. And so I know that I am dealing with something that's way more powerful than me. And I know exactly what it means in our book when it says the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. And to me, my alcoholic life had seemed come to be the only normal one for me. But if I'm suffering from this illness that is way more powerful than me, and if I want to have any recovery from that thing today, what's going to have to happen? I'm going to have to find something that is way more powerful than me and way more powerful than this thing. And that's been the gift that you've given me here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I never set out to end up where I ended up. I did not go out looking for that long yellow couch, but that's where I ended up in 1984. I was raised better than that. I come from a typical South Tulsa family. My father was a lawyer, and my mother was a saint. And it was 1962, and my mother had, she was an incredibly beautiful woman with hair taller than anybody else's. And she had those cat-eye glasses with the rhinestones around the corner. That was Mom. And we were middle-class Catholics in the 60s, and that's about like what today you would refer to as a yuppie, because my parents were extremely upwardly mobile. And my father, he was the president of the Bar Association, and he was the head of his own firm, and he was the president of everything he wasn't chairman of. And my mother was an early trophy wife, you know, what today we refer to as a trophy wife. And she was into charity activities and civic activities. And I had about the most apple pie mom kind of upbringing that you can imagine in the South Tulsa suburb, where, as far as I knew, everything was normal. That's what I knew at the time. Now, my father was drinking alcoholically at this time. And I can say that because he came to say that. He was an alcoholic, and he drank for many years. Now, by the time my father passed away in 1991, he had 20 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. But when I was growing up, he was drinking. And he continued to end up in places that he had not set out to go. And he was always ashamed, and he was always embarrassed. And I said when I was a kid that I was never, ever going to grow up to turn out like anything like that drunken son of a bitch that was my father. And I can tell you that by the time I was 17 years old, I had turned out exactly like that drunken son of a bitch that was my father. And I was ashamed of it, and I couldn't talk to him. And so the relationship between me and my father was cut off very early in my life. I can remember being a little kid and my father being absent all the time. And we would always go look for him. And I don't know why we did that, you know? I mean, we didn't want him there. But every time he turned up missing, it seemed like, you know, my mom would put all four of those kids in that car in the middle of the night and we would go look for that man. My dad came home in the middle of the night one time with we had a white 1962 Ford station wagon. He came home with the back of that station wagon full of stolen television sets. And he had no idea where he had gotten them. Now, my father was the president of the Bar Association. So, you know, he was not a fence man for major household appliances, and so this seemed kind of strange. But my mother had a plan. Looking back today, I know that nothing my father ever did drunk was as bad as my mother's reaction to it. But my mother had a plan, and the plan was, one more time, she got all four of those kids up in the middle of the night, and we put our coats on top of our pajamas, and we drove that station wagon out to like 56th Street North on Peoria in Tulsa, where's the city limits, and we dropped down the tailgate of the station wagon. With our legs, we pushed those TVs out in the middle of the road. We closed the car up, went back home, went back to bed, and never mentioned it again. So, okay, now I'm 4 years old, right, and I got my first tool for living. And the tool is, if something seems the least bit strange or intolerable, you just don't talk about it. You don't mention it, and you never talk about it again. As a matter of fact, it might not have happened at all. And, you know, when you grow up in a house like that, you develop a weird ability to live in the world, and you get these social skills that are unlike the social skills of the people around you. And so maybe you can relate with this. I sort of had the feeling when I started entering school and started trying to interact with other people, I had the feeling that somehow I did not quite fit with the people around me. It seemed like I was never in the right place at the right time, or something like that. It seemed like everyone knew something that I didn't know. And I couldn't have told you what it was that they supposedly knew. But it seemed as if there was one day when there was orientation, and I was gone that day. You know, and everybody, I was like, I was absent on the day they handed out the rules. And men knew how to be men, and I didn't know how to do that. And sons knew how to be sons, and students knew how to be students, and I didn't know how to do any of that stuff. And I was just, I was uncomfortable inside my skin. It wasn't that I was uncomfortable in my home or that I was uncomfortable in school. I was uncomfortable in my skin. And so all my life, all my early years of my life, I went around with a feeling that I've heard my friend Bob describe before as I just wanted to feel like you looked. You know, I looked at the outside of you, and all around me, I seemed like people knew, you know, you looked as if you knew where you were going and you understood where you had been. And I didn't have that. I later discovered you didn't feel like you looked either, but I didn't know it at the time. I look at the outside of you and compare that with the inside of me and lost. And one night when I was 15 years old, I went to a party, a New Year's Eve party when I was 15 years old. And it was at a friend's house. His parents were having a party. It was a very big house. And the parents were in the living room and the dining room and the family room. And there was about 10 high school age kids that had sort of migrated down to this family room in this converted basement area. And we were having our own New Year's Eve party down there, although the parents upstairs didn't know it. And, you know, when you're 15 years old, where I'm from, you can't buy liquor. And so you just whatever you can get away with, you know, whatever. We did a little sleight of hand. And what we ended up with that night was a 3-gallon bottle of Chivas Regal Scotch. You know that novelty size they put in the window of the liquor store? Well, my friend's dad had bought this for the centerpiece of the bar. And it turned up missing. And so we've got a dozen 15-year-olds in this basement with 3 gallons of scotch and 1 6-pack of Coca-Cola. So we were drinking scotch and Coke. And it's in this little, like, family TV room where there was a little wet bar down there, but normally they don't have parties down there. And so all they have down there is ice and great big tumblers because they would usually just be drinking soft drinks. So we're drinking out of these big glasses this tall. I did it right from the very beginning. And we're sitting down there with 6 cans of Coke and 3 gallons of scotch. And I've always been a leader. In fact, I'm very resourceful. And I looked at that scotch and I looked at the 6 cans of Coke and I did a little quick math in my head. And I realized that we're going to have to go really easy on that Coke if we're going to make this work. See, I haven't even had my first drink in my whole life yet, okay? I've never tasted alcohol yet. And I'm right away trying to figure out how to get rid of all the liquor and all the mixer at the same time. I've always had this sort of innate resourcefulness. And I gave the advice to the group, and they followed my group conscience. And so we took these big tumblers, and we were filling them like 2/3 of the way full with scotch. And then you would get, you know, your ration of the ice cube and a little bit of Coke on top. And when somebody put that drink in front of me that night, I don't know how I knew this, but somehow I knew that I was moments away from a new freedom and a new happiness, and that I was about to be rocketed into a fourth dimension that up until this time I had only dreamt of. And I lifted that thing up to my face like this, and the first thing that I did was I smelled it. And I can still, standing right here, I can still smell it. Every time I think about it, I get a chill down my spine. Because it was the most vile, hideous, disgusting smell that I think I'd ever smelled before. So I drank it, you know. I took a big mouthful of the stuff, and when I got it in my mouth, I thought, oh God, I've made a mistake. But you stick your chin out like this, and you lean back a little bit and swallow hard, and I did it. You know, I was done. I knew that I had done what I had to do. And I still can feel it going down my throat. It just seemed to burn. And when it hit my stomach, it was like a bomb. It was like I felt parts of my body that I had never even been aware existed before that time. And it was as if it was rotating in me. And in a few minutes, I could feel totally different than I felt minutes before. And it was as if I didn't even know that I was nervous until I started to relax. And I drank that drink that night, and in a short time, something happened to me that had never happened before. And what it was is that I felt like you looked. suddenly, with that drink in my hand and part of it in my body, I achieved everything that I wanted out of life. I felt the way you looked. And I was able to talk to the guys, and I was able to dance with the girls, and I was able to just be. I was able, for the first time in my life, to be comfortable inside my skin. And I had never had that feeling before. And so on that night, I started a love affair with alcohol that went on and on and on. And I spent the next 7 years trying to get back that same feeling that I had that night and never quite getting it again. It seemed like every night after that, for the next 7 years, I was trying to just get the right combination of this, that, and the other, and just in the right amounts to get back to that feeling where I felt the way you looked. And I somehow always would, you know, go into a blackout before I got there, and people say, yeah, you seem fine, but you know. Or I would be drinking along and think, I just need a little bit more, and then I'll be there, and the next thing you know, it's the next morning, and I'm waking up, and I have no idea what happened. And when you drink the way that I drink, that you go to places that you didn't set out to go. And I did. University of Oklahoma, for example. I got a scholarship to Southern Missouri, and I went to Southern Missouri for 1 year on this full-ride scholarship, and I was drinking at the time, and some events happened. It was very unfair, you know, but they kicked me out, you know, and took away my scholarship. And, you know, when you're 19 years old and washed up, you know, what do? You go to OU. So I did. I got in the car and I went to the University of Oklahoma, and they were glad to have me there, you know. It was just the element that I needed. This is a university with over 20,000 students, and you can be totally anonymous. And I went to the University of Oklahoma for 3.5 years and chalked up 12 credit hours. That's what happened. If you don't know about college credit, that should take like 12 weeks, not 3.5 years. And I drank and I drank and I drank. I was living in Norman, Oklahoma, and working in Oklahoma City, which is like a 25-minute drive away. And I had one of those jobs at the time that requires you to drink. I was a waiter. And I drank on the job, before the job, and after the job. I drank all the time, basically. But we used to go to this restaurant, and I worked in an expensive restaurant and made really good money in cash tips. In 1984, I'm making $35,000 a year in cash tips 15 years ago. Electricity cut off, because I cannot get any of that money home and into the bank. And because we would work until after midnight, but then we would go down to the street to this nightclub called the Photo Finish Lounge. And it was in the Hilton Inn on South Meridian in Oklahoma City. And our book describes how we seek out lower environments when we're drinking. And this was one of mine. And we used to go to this place every single night and close this place down every single night for years. In fact, one night at about, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, my friends started to go through what was by this time routine, and that was to find Mitch, because I turned up missing so often. And they found me this night laying outside in a ditch. And I had been in a fight with two guys, and I had not won. And I was laying in this ditch covered in mud and dead grass clippings, because they had just cut the grass. And I had a cut that went from the middle of my forehead down to the top of my nose and over this eye and down this cheek. And my eye is filled with blood and it's swollen shut like that. And I got a fat lip. And my friends throw me in this car to take me home to Brenda, who was a girl that I lived with at the time. And Brenda had not discovered the miracle of the Al-Anon family groups. And so she was at the designated post at the assigned time. You know, it's 2:30 in the morning and she's standing at that front door in the Al-Anon pose, you know, like this. And she's doing that thing, you know, where they tap their foot to the where their whole body moves. And my friends drive by, and, you know, they're scared of her. So they just slow down the car long enough to push me out the door. And so I'm crawling up the driveway because I was tired of falling. So I started crawling, and I'm still covered in mud and dead grass clippings, and I go through that oil slick in the driveway, because I had one of those cars that bleeds the oil, you know? And, I used to think that it was a natural element of cars that they bled big spots of oil on the driveway. My car died as a direct result of alcoholism back then. But I go through that oil slick, and I get to the first step, and Brenda's standing there like this, singing the national anthem of Al-Anon, which is like that. And, you know, I'm just trying to not be noticed. And, well, she sees me. And she says the strangest thing to me, you guys. She says this thing, I'll never forget looking up at her like that. And she looks down at me and she says, if you can't control yourself when you start to drink, why do you drink at all? Have you ever heard of such bullshit as that? I mean... When I think about that today, it seems like a good question today. Back then, I had no idea what she was talking about. She might as well have been speaking Portuguese. And so, laying there with a gash from here to here and a fat lip and my eyes swollen shut with blood and caked in mud and dead grass clippings, I said, I drink because it's fun. But that's not the funny part. The funny part is I was serious. I was totally 100% serious. That was as much as I knew at the time. You know, drinking had been fun for me for a while, and I'm glad it was there. I might have killed myself, or I might have killed somebody else because I needed it for a while, and all I could remember was that it had been fun for a while. And, I remember when I got here the first time, I would sit in AA meetings, and I would listen to people read out of the book, and I couldn't read because I couldn't see because I had this goo in my eyes. It looked like I was looking through, like wax paper because I'd been putting vanilla extract in my eyes for 3 years. And I would sit there in the meetings, and they would read the book to me because I couldn't see. And one night, I'm sitting in the meeting, and somebody reads to me this part of our book that says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And that night in the meeting, as if with no control whatsoever, I blurted out, duh, just like that. I just blurted it out. I couldn't believe somebody had to write that down in a book. Yes, of course, we drink because we like the effect produced by alcohol. What else? I didn't know some of you liars are sitting around here talking about you drink for the taste. What? I like the taste of Pepsi, but I never drank a case of Pepsi, you know. And by this time, I'm drinking Aquanet, Final Net, all your biggies. I'm not drinking for the taste. But laying on that porch that night, what I didn't know is that, yes, it had been fun for a while, and I drank for the effect produced by alcohol, but the effect had changed for me. And that happened without my consent, without my permission, and without my awareness. And the effect had changed, and alcohol was in the process of trying to kill me, and I didn't even know it. And the effect had changed. And so I know what it means when it says our main problem centers in our mind rather than our body. And to us, our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. Because also, by this time in my life, I was very adept at surrounding myself with people that were just like me, so that I didn't have to stick out any. And if you didn't drink the way I did, I did not have much use for you at all. I could not be around you at all. We had a name for it back then. We called it cool. She's cool. You know, that meant she's as big a loser as we are, and she won't tell anyone what we have in here. And I surrounded myself with these people, and so that I didn't have to look at what was going on with me. Back then, I woke up in my car a lot, and I also thought that was just a natural thing that happens. You know, every once in a while, you wake up in your car. Today, I know dozens of people who have never woken up in their car. And, when you wake up in your car, you know, when I woke up this morning, what happened was I slowly became aware that I was waking up. My eyes weren't even open, and I slowly became aware of my surroundings. And what I thought about this morning when I first woke up was I thought about what a great meeting we had last night and what a great group of people had invited me here, and I was surrounded by people that wanted the best for me, and I knew that God had made a day for me today that I was going to be able to live and go through without a drink and enjoy you people and get to bed tonight not only having not taken a drink, but that I was going to know some peace while I did that. That's the way I woke up today. That's not the way you wake up in your car. You wake up in your car like this. I used to wake up in my car all the time. And it was a good day for me if I woke up in my car. You know, because on other days, I would just have to wake up and go look for my car anyway. So the way I looked at it back then, if I woke up in my car, I was hours ahead. So I wake up in my car this day, and you know, there's a procedure for waking up in your car. And the procedure is you get out, check the body for damage, small animals embedded in the grill, and you find the keys. And then You drive around and look for something you recognize. No problem. But this one day, I wake up in my car, and I go through the procedure, and I drove around for a long time, and I did not see anything that I recognized. And I was starting to get a little scared when I pulled over to this filling station, and I asked this guy how to get back to I-35. Now, I-35 runs right through the middle of Oklahoma City. Everybody in Oklahoma City knows how to get back to I-35. Well, this guy did not know how to get back to I-35. So he goes in this filling station, and they have this map that's that big. It covers the whole wall of the filling station. And he goes, okay, go over here and turn left and turn right, and then get on I-40 and drive for like 20 hours. So I'm cool. So I says to this guy, now here comes the magic question. I says to this guy, where am I? Exactly. And he said, Phoenix, Arizona. Oh, you laugh. I have no idea why I went to Phoenix, Arizona. No clue. I don't know how I got there, what route I took. I don't know where I slept or where I ate or if I ate. None of those moments have ever come back to me. And 5 days are missing from the calendar. And I think that blackouts are God's way of saying, you really don't want to know. And because I have great faith in God, I know that there is a special place in hell reserved for those people to wake up the next day and go, you want to know what you did last night? I go, no. Leave it there. So I got back on I-40, and I drove 20 hours back to I-35 that day, and I did not think that was strange because I didn't think about it at all. You know what I mean? A lot of this stuff might have seemed really strange if I would have thought about it at all, but I just didn't. I was doing what I had to do, and at the time, I can tell you, I was doing the best I could with the information that I had. But that day, whenever I got back to my house in Norman, I walked in the kitchen, and there was an answering machine on the counter there, and the light, you know, is going like this. And I walked over to the answering machine, and I pushed the button, and one of the first messages on the machine was from my brother, and he was calling me from Tulsa, which was unusual because he lived in New York at the time. And he's calling from Tulsa to Norman, Oklahoma, which is about 2 hours away. And he said, Mitch, listen, I've tried a couple of times and I couldn't catch it, and I didn't want to put this on your machine, but listen, Dad's had a stroke and he's in the hospital and you need to come home right away. And I was gripped with fear in that moment because I had figured out by this time that I had been gone for 5 days and I did not know how long that message had been there. And so I sat there and I listened, you know, to a few more of the messages that come from the people that call us when we're living the way we live. And then I hear my brother's voice again and he goes, Mitch, what's the matter? Didn't you get the message? This is what's happening. Dad's in the hospital and you need to come home right away. And then a few more messages went by from the kind of people that call us when we're living the way we live. And I heard my brother's voice again and he said, look, Mitch, I know what's happening. But you have to pull it together this time. This is really important. And I stood there and I waited for my brother's voice to come on the answering machine again. And as I waited, as a few more of those messages went by from the people that call us when we live that way, the voices all just started to melt into one. And I was listening for my brother's voice again, and all the words were just words, and I couldn't hear what they were saying, and I was just waiting to hear my brother's voice again. And I believe that in that moment, as I waited for that last message from my brother, I believe that I stood in a place mentally where I could have taken one step that way and never come back because I was so terrified and so ashamed that I almost could not inhabit my body anymore. And I believe that I have been all the way to the edge. But by the grace of God, I stood and inhabited my body for another second until my brother's voice came on the answering machine again and said, Mitch, look, just stay away. Just stay away. And he was a good man for doing it, I know, today. He was protecting my mother and the rest of my family, and he was living the best life that he could at the time. And my father walked out of the hospital that time, so I was very, very lucky or very blessed or something. But I was so ashamed and so embarrassed that I just, you know, I did what I had to do. I didn't talk to anyone in my family for years after that. I turned away because what do you say? What do you do? When people are living their lives that way and they're not living the way that I have to live on a daily basis, and you do things like that unintentionally, I had no knowledge of that whole 5 days, and I come back and these are the results of my life. What do? The only thing that I knew how to do at that time was turn away and run away, and that's what I did. And I didn't talk to any of them until after I got sober. When you're living that way, the way that I had to live at the time, it seemed that all I needed to do was figure out what was wrong with me. And if I could treat that one thing, then everything would be okay. And I can remember trying to figure out what was wrong with me, and really trying. I thought at one time that the problem was that I had the wrong job, so I switched jobs. And I got fired from the job that I switched to, that was supposed to solve all of this. And then there was one time when I decided I lived in the wrong place, so I moved. And I got evicted from the place that I moved to, that was supposed to solve this. Then I realized the problem is I didn't have a girlfriend. So I got a girlfriend and she moved in. And after a time she goes, look, I can't take this anymore, and she left. And she was supposed to solve the problem. And I didn't know until after you explained it to me when I got here that these were all external treatments or external solutions to a problem that was internal. The problem was inside me and I had not treated that. And there came a time when something happened to me. It says in our big book, describes it as all my scorecards read zero. And I had no more choices left. And I did at that time the only thing that I knew how to do. I was 22 years old, spoiled brat from a South Tulsa neighborhood. And so I loaded everything that I had into two paper bags. And I went home to mom and dad. And I showed up on my parents' doorstep. And they let me in. And I don't know why they let me in, but they let me in. Now, my father was sober 13 years in Alcoholics Anonymous by this time. And my mother was this 14-year black belt Al-Anon, and there's no shucking and jiving going on around there. Oh, I thought I'd made a big mistake when I move in with this picture of sobriety and serenity, you know, and I'm drinking hairspray around the clock by this time. And I know that it was the beginning of the miracle for me because they never once mentioned my drinking to me. And I don't know how you do that either, but they never mentioned my drinking to me. And yet the way they lived was so different than the way that I lived, I was no longer able to do that one thing that I had to do, which was surround myself with people who were just like me. And I can tell you that as a result of observing their lives, the difference was so stark that I could not ignore it anymore. And I moved in there on September the 1st, and my sobriety date is September the 15th of 1984, because of the way that they lived. And I can remember on that September the 15th when we had gone through something. I don't know, it was the drama du jour. There was one every day. And it had been, again, I had done something, and they had to talk to me. And when they left the house that night, I had a moment that I think you may only get one of these. I'm not sure. You may get two. I'm going to let this one be enough for me, because what happened was a thing that a lady in the story section of our book describes it the best when she says, what happened was the walls crumbled and the light streamed in. Because in an instant, I knew what was wrong with me, and I knew where the solution was. And I can tell you that 5 minutes before I knew, I didn't know. But I had prayed to God for a long time to do something for me, and I didn't know what it was going to be. But there came that time when my walls crumbled and the light streamed in, and so I knew where the help was, too, because I'd been seeing it demonstrated for me day after day. And so I picked up the phone that night, and I dialed 627-2224. And in Northeast Oklahoma, that's Alcoholics Anonymous. And we have it really good there. That phone is always answered by an alcoholic. There's no answering service. There's no answering machine. It's always answered by an alcoholic, 24 hours a day, every day of the year. And I was so grateful for that. It was like 7:30 at night, and a voice comes on the other end and says, "Hello?" And I said, "Is this Alcoholics Anonymous?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "Well, I think I might have a drinking problem." And he said, "Well, I found a solution that works for me, and it's all about a daily reprieve that's contingent on my maintenance of a spiritual program." And I thought, who is this guy? a daily reprieve contingent on my maintenance of a special program? What's that? How do you not drink? How do you not take a drink? And he said to me, well, I think you need to go to a meeting. There's one tonight. And I said, well, I can't go tonight. I've got things to do. Now, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1984, I was 6 feet tall, just like I am right now. And right now, I weigh 190 pounds, and back then I weighed 128 pounds. So one-third of me is gone. You can put your middle finger and your thumb around my arm up at the shoulder, and it goes all the way around. My skin was gray, and my eyes were so yellow they looked orange. I was shaking visibly, and I don't mean that I was trembling. I mean, you didn't even have to be sitting close to me to see that I was moving. I would just be sitting there and I'd go, what did I have to do? I didn't know it at the time, but I was already suffering from my very first ego trip inside Alcoholics Anonymous, because I didn't want to come to your meeting the way that I looked that night, because I thought you wouldn't like me, and I wanted to have a few days to clean up and sober up before I came to your meeting. Little did I know, it only got worse for the first few days. And so he says to me, well, when do you think you could squeeze it in? And I said, well, I think Monday would be about the quickest I could get around to it. This is on a Thursday. And he said, I suggest to you that you pray to God, whether you believe this or not, I suggest that you pray to God that he would keep you sober one day at a time and get you to that meeting on Monday night. And I hung up the phone, and I had no reason to do this, but I followed what the guy said, because I knew that, you know, I had made a beginning here. I had approached AA for the first time, and I didn't want to jinx my sobriety, even though I hadn't been to a meeting yet. I wanted to follow the directions so that in a few weeks when it had not worked, I would be able to say, I did everything, and it did not work for me, and so I get to go now. May I please be excused? And that next day, I said a prayer to a God that I did not understand or believe in. Would you please keep me sober today and get me to that meeting Monday night? And when I went to bed that night, I had not taken a drink, and I couldn't believe it. And the same thing happened the next day and the next. And I couldn't believe it when 3 days later on a Monday night, I showed up in the middle of September in Tulsa, Oklahoma, on the doorstep of Alcoholics Anonymous, 3 days past my last drink with no program of action going on in my life. I'm like, there was a lady there that got sober with my father that likes to describe it this way. She said, you looked exactly like Frankenstein in a hurry. Because I'm like, and this guy told me that he would meet me at the door, and I just went right past him. You know, I didn't know who he was. He later told me he knew exactly who I was. But I go in that meeting, and before I even get to my chair, somebody said something to me that was everything I remember from my first meeting, and so I want to tell you what it was. As I walked into the door, I got a few steps inside the door, and somebody said to me, our coffee's over here, and you can sit by me. And that's everything that I remember from that first meeting. Our coffee's over here, and you can sit by me. And I believe that in that instant, that man did for me the most important 12-step work that we do. And I say that to you, having chaired conventions, and I'm acting right now as the delegate for Area 57, the state of Oklahoma, and I participated in your General Service Conference in New York 2 weeks ago. And I've sponsored dozens of men, and I've been the chairman of an area, but the most important work that I do is when I go to my group 45 minutes early and I stand outside the door, and if I don't know you, I'm going to say, our coffee's over here and you can sit by me, because I think that's the most important work that we do. And I'm so grateful that he did that for me that night, because I might not have even gotten to a chair. I was so scared. But I sat in that meeting, and somebody said, you know, keep coming back. And I did. I mean, where was I going to go? You know, it wasn't like, do you want to go to Hawaii or do you want to go to AA? I mean, I was running out of choices fast. So I go back the next night, and I sit in your meetings, and I really was trying. I was trying my hardest to understand, and I was trying to listen. But I couldn't. I was just weird and just so messed up and so just crispy in the head. That I couldn't pay attention, and I really tried, but you would get two words out and I would be lost. As what you sounded like Charlie Brown's teacher to me. You were like wah 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 wah, you know, and I'm going like this. I'd sit that way for 2 hours and then go home, and that was Alcoholics Anonymous to me. But people kept inviting me back, and they were nice to me, and I came back to the meeting, and somewhere in there I heard it said that I should get a sponsor. That was very popular back then. So I did. I got that guy that answered the phone that night to be my sponsor.
I went up to him and said, Gene, would you be my sponsor? And he said, yes! And poor Gene. More was revealed to him. Oh, I cracked myself up. Gene was one of the kindest men that I've ever met in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he sponsored me from A to Z. I mean, nothing was too much. Gene taught me how to pray, and he taught me how to shave. I knew nothing. I didn't know anything. I was living like an animal. Gene taught me some of the headiest things and some of the simplest things. Gene told me back then, I can remember him telling me, that there's nobody anywhere who has anything in here or in here that you don't have. And he said, do you believe me? And I said, no. I don't believe you. And he said, well, do you believe that I believe it? And I thought about that and I said, yeah, I believe that you believe it. And I did. I thought he was a little touched. But I believed that Gene believed this. And he told me, I personally guarantee you, Mitch, I personally guarantee you that if you will come back here and if you will do the things that we did, you will get the things that we got. And he said, I promise you, if you follow directions and work the steps and pursue this thing called a spiritual awakening, there will come a time when you believe it too. And I said, okay, I'll come back and see what happens. And Gene worked with me those early years, and he sponsored me just the way that I needed to. He told me very often exactly what I should do. But he also started to teach me how to pray and how to make decisions and how to listen for inspiration. And one of the hardest times in my sobriety was in 1991 when we had to bury Gene. Because somehow in his 14th year of sobriety, after saving my life and saving so many other men's lives, Gene came to the conclusion that his life was no longer worth living. And he closed himself up in that garage and he rolled down the windows to the car and he sat there and he started that car and just sat there and waited until it was over. And Gene did this stone cold sober. And from that day until this, I don't really have anything good to say about Gene's passing in that way, except that I can tell you that Gene taught me in the beginning and he taught me in the end that if I'm going to have anything from Alcoholics Anonymous, what I'm going to have is a daily reprieve contingent on my maintenance of a spiritual program today. And today is the day that I have to be willing to go to any length in order to stay sober. Today is the day that I have to pursue a spiritual awakening the way I pursued a spiritual awakening back in 1984 when I was trembling visibly. Today is the day that I've got to be willing to go to any lengths. This is the day that I have to be willing to tell you my story so that I can remember what it was like. And I can tell you that as long as I have lived this way, it has not been necessary for me to do anything self-destructive to myself. It has not been necessary for me to take a drink. But beyond that, people, the most important thing is that I know peace while I live this way. I have a way of life today that is unlike anything that I ever really dreamt of. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't looking for a spiritual awakening. I didn't want a spiritual experience or a power greater than myself that allowed me to live. All I wanted when I got here was to stop falling down and throwing up. That's all I wanted. And what you gave me instead was a different way to feel all day long. What you did was you taught me how to love, and you taught me how to be of service, and you taught me how to know a power greater than myself. And I can't express to you my gratitude for that. I've been trying for many, many years, and I just don't have the words to describe it. But in coming to AA and living differently, I started to work the steps and do some things that my sponsor suggested to me, and I wanted to put back some of the things that have been destroyed in my life. And one of the things that I was most ashamed of, I was only 22 years old when I got sober. And so at that time, one of the things that I was the most ashamed of was that I was 22 years old, and I had blown college out the back door, and had really no aim in life and no place to go. And I decided that I wanted to try to put that back. I wanted to try to go back to school. And so when I was just 3 months sober, I showed up at the University of Tulsa, which is a very good private school. And I have this transcript from OU that reads like an arrest warrant. You know, it just rolls out on the floor. Blah, 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 and it's just F. Because I, you know, some people are professional students. Well, I was a professional enroller. I would just enroll and then never go. And I thought every semester it was going to be different. You know, I just needed to get that semester behind me and get a fresh start. Alcoholics need a fresh start. That's all we really need. And every semester, I would enroll again, and I would buy new pencils, and it was just never different. And so I have classes that I've paid for and enrolled in 3 times and never seen the instructor. And so when I go to this really good private school, this lady, I'll never forget, she's standing there and she goes, "What's that?" And I took a big risk and I told her the truth. I said, "That was then and this is now, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm a recovered alcoholic, and I want you to let me try to go to your school." And I can still remember standing there, she was looking at me like this, and she said, "I don't know anything about what you're talking about. I don't even know if you're telling me the truth, but I'll tell you what I'm going to do," she said. "I will let you in this school, and I don't have to do that." And she said, "I'll let you in this school on what we call grade 5 academic probation." I'd never even heard of anything like that. I've always had great distinctions in life. And she said, "This is the deal. You go only part-time. You're not a member of any club or organization. You do not get a basketball ticket. If you get any C's, you're out of here. If you miss one class period, you're out of here. And if I get any bad feedback from any of your instructors, you're out of here. And I'm going to talk to all your instructors every week. How's that?" And I said, "Okay." And so I started to go back to school one day at a time. One day at a time. And I lived the way that you had taught me to live. My sponsor told me back then, "If you will just iron your shirt and show up early and don't hit anybody and don't steal anything, you'll be surprised how far you can go on just those simple values." It's all new to me, so that's what I did. And I went that first semester and I got 2 A's. And then I went back and I showed that grade card to that lady. Ha, ha, ha. And she said, "That's great. You've just got one more year of academic probation." And I thought, a year, taking 2 classes at a time, and I get out the calculator and I figure out I'm going to be 120 years old by the time I graduate at this rate. But I did it, you know, because it was where I was. I remember telling my sponsor, "You know, if I could just get to a starting place, I would start." And he explained to me, "There's no such thing as a starting place. Wherever you are right now, that's the starting place. So start." And so I was where I was, and I started where I was, and that was my starting place. And I went another year on academic probation, and I got straight A's the whole time I was on academic probation. And I got off of that probation. And I didn't make straight A's the whole time that I was in school, but I finished. And that was something. It may have been the first thing that I ever finished in my entire life. And because of the way you taught me to live, and because of just ironing my shirt and showing up early and not hitting anybody and not stealing anything, imagine my surprise when, in my senior year, I was elected as the president of the academic organization in my major field, and I couldn't believe it. But I prayed for God's will in my life, and I continued just to live the way that you taught me to live. And some ideas came to me, and I started taking some actions. And while I was the president of that academic organization, I started a little trust fund that's still there and is self-perpetuating. And the interest alone off of it awards 2 scholarships to people in my major field. And I cannot believe that the gifts that God has given me, the things that I've had front row seats to since I have been sober and living with the principles that you give me. I can't believe it. And, you know, one of the most damaged relationships in my life was with my father. I already told you. He was laying in that hospital bed with a stroke, and I was in Phoenix, Arizona on a 5-day blackout. And after I got sober, and I'm even living under his roof, and I can barely talk to him. Because this is a guy that intimidated me all my life. He was larger than life to me. My father was one of the most successful men that I ever knew. He was good-looking, had tons of friends, and he basically scared me to death. And particularly after I had betrayed him that time, I just had no way to look him in the eye, and it was painful to live that way. Because, I mean, this is my dad. I used to think this made me very unique. I thought I was the only guy in Alcoholics Anonymous that couldn't look his dad in the eye. I've come to find, you know, that's what we do, you know. But I said to my sponsor, "How do you heal a relationship with somebody that you can't even be in the same room with?" And I thought I had him. You know, I thought I was off the hook. I thought this was the freebie. Okay, you don't have to work the steps. And he said, "Get a load of this. Will you start by being in the same room with him?" You could have given me from then to now, and I'd have never come up with that. That's just the kind of thing you need sponsors for. And I said, but I don't have anything to say to him. And he said, you start where you are. That's the starting place. So I started going around my father, and we have no use for each other whatsoever. But we discovered pretty early in there that we have one common interest, and that was baseball. So we would watch baseball on TV, and the baseball game would be on TV, and we would watch it. And when the game was over, we'd turn off the TV, and I would leave. And that was my relationship with my father. And I went to my sponsor, and I said, this is pathetic. And he said, but it's something. And I was further along than what I had been the week before or the month before. And one time I can remember being at my dad's, and we're watching this baseball game on TV, and we start talking about baseball. I mean, you know, God forbid it should be about anything. But we talk at least about the baseball game that was on TV. And I would go to my father, my sponsor, and I would say, this is really, really pathetic. And he would say, but it's something. And it's more than you had the last week. It never occurred to me that I was going to be able to take these little tiny baby steps to solve this huge problem. I just looked at this insurmountable, gigantic problem and never even wanted to approach it until my sponsor said, you start where you are and you take these little baby steps. And one time we're watching a baseball game at my dad's house, and I look up and I realize my dad and I are talking about my brother. And the game is over. And I don't know who's won. Because God did what God does when I show up and pray for God's will in my life. I couldn't have planned that. I wouldn't have anticipated that. And if you had told me this is the way you do it, I wouldn't have been able to do it. But what I did was I prayed for inspiration, and I showed up where I was supposed to be. And God did what God is supposed to do. And my dad became one of my best friends. I also want to tell you about one of the greatest joys in my life has been working in Alcoholics Anonymous and General Service. And if you've never done this, I encourage you to get involved. When I was early in my sobriety, it was suggested to me that if I would become a GSR, which, you know, I used to be an SOB, and then I... My sponsor said, become a GSR, and I became a GSR. I didn't even know what that meant. You know, I was at the first meeting of the GSRs before, that's a group service representative, and a general service representative. And I started meeting the nicest people in Alcoholics Anonymous, the people that do what we refer to as general service. Now, I've already told you, I believe the most important work in AA is done at our door, and I still believe that. But it's a real blessing still to be involved with the general service that feeds through the areas into the General Service Conference in Alcoholics Anonymous in New York. I was a GSR, and then a DCM, and then an area service chair, and then an area chair, and then finally a delegate. And I got to represent Oklahoma to the General Service Conference of New York, or of Alcoholics Anonymous in New York last April. And it was one of the most moving experiences of my life. And I got to tell you, and I get to give my delegates report in my area, so I won't do that here tonight. But if I had to narrow that 6 days, and we went from 7 in the morning till 9:30 at night for 6 days, and handled some of AA's most sensitive business, and if I had only 5 seconds to tell you what it was like, what I would tell you was, God is still in control of AA, even at the world level. I saw the most... It was the most moving thing to see people come and really listen. You know, they had their minds made up when they got there, but they really listened. And I saw people change their mind after they heard input from people halfway across the country. And God could not have been any more obvious in that room at the General Service Conference if he had been riding a bicycle up and down the aisles. And I'm convinced that Alcoholics Anonymous is in good hands into the coming centuries. Back in April of 1993, I can't believe it was that long ago, I started on a moving and fascinating adventure that I didn't know where it was going, let alone how fast. But what happened was, one day I got mad at my boss, and I decided to apply to graduate school just to, you know, mess with him. And the next day, I couldn't remember what I was even mad about, but this application was on its way to me in the mail. And I decided to go through with this process, even though I knew that I couldn't go, because it was, you know, it was $10,000 a year, and there's just no way. And I applied because I wanted to see if I could get into school without being on academic probation, despite my past. I was going to see if that was going to haunt me again, or if, as a result of living this way and having made some amends to that university, if they were going to let me in like a real person, even though I knew that I couldn't go. And I took the test, the GMAT, and then in 5 weeks, I got my scores back, and I had gotten one of those scores that never happens. And the man from the university called me right after I got my mail. He had gotten the scores the same time, and he said, look, we got your scores here, and we just want to tell you, you've been admitted to this school. And that was everything that I wanted, to know that I could get in just because of the way you had taught me to live and the way I had rebuilt my life. But he said, I was thinking, yeah, great, how, you know, I've got this guy on the phone. How do I tell him it was all just a game, you know? And before I could say anything, he said to me, with this score like this, you're going to get recruited by other schools. And so before that gets too distracting for you, I'm calling to tell you, we'd like to pay for all your tuition for your whole master's degree, and we will pay you green money to come to our school. And I said, okay. And so I accidentally got a master's degree. Back in between 1993 and 1995, I worked full-time and went to graduate school full-time and worked part-time as a teaching assistant at the university one day at a time. It was the hardest thing I think I'd ever done. But I couldn't believe that God had brought me to that place for no reason at all. And so I prayed for the knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry it out. And in 1995, as a result, my master's degree was concentrated in international business, and I had a chance to go to Europe to represent our university, and they had a number of qualified applicants, and they chose me to go to Europe and be part of a university and work over in Europe, and I couldn't believe it. I prayed to God again for the knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry it out, and as I went on this trip, I was going to Belgium, and everything that you can think of that could go wrong went wrong. When I am in the air on the way over there, the air traffic controllers in Brussels go on strike. And we're circling the English Channel for like 5 hours. While I am in the air over the ocean, the company that I'm going to work for over there is sold. And everything's all shaken up. I get to Brussels, and the hotel where I'm supposed to stay has no reservation for me. Belgium is half French and half Dutch, and I speak French, but I do not speak Dutch. And I find out that my job is in the Dutch half of the country. And I have no hotel room, and nothing is going right, and I am thousands of miles away from home. And I got down on my knees in the bathroom of that hotel lobby, and I prayed for the knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry it out. And I came out of the bathroom, and there's a thing on the wall, and there's like a tourist guide or something that says, call this number and we'll find you a hotel. So I called the number, and they said, where are you? How much do you want to spend? They said, we'll send a cab. And I got in this cab, and I had no idea where I'm going. And they let me out, and I get out, and I go in this hotel, and I walk inside, and they check me in, and I go to the room, and the room is almost big enough to walk around the twin bed, you know, if you've ever seen one of these European hotel rooms. And I was so scared. I had fear like I hadn't had since my very early sobriety. And I thought, maybe this is really the time that God has brought me safely thus far just to drop me on my ass right here. And I walked over to the window, and I, after saying that prayer, and I opened up the windows. And the streets in Brussels are almost wide enough to push a thimble down. And so the building across the street, which is also just like 3 stories tall, is you can almost lean out and touch it. And in the window right across from my hotel room is a circle and a triangle. And I went across the street. And it was like 11:30 in the morning. And I went in there, and there was a noon meeting. And I sat in there with those people, and I thought, God's in Belgium, you know? It was just incredible to me. I can only tell you that I don't have words to describe what's happened to me since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I can tell you that I believe today that it's real. And I want to tell you about the time that I came to believe, and then I'm going to be through. So I want to thank the committee again for getting me here. I probably had about 60 days of sobriety when I was looking around, and all I could see was what was different about me than other people. And the people around me were talking about this thing called a spiritual awakening, and I had not had a spiritual awakening. I was just shaking, and I was just weird all the time. And people would say that they would pray, you know, and the heavens would open up, and stars and flowers would pour down upon them. And, you know, I prayed, and none of that happened to me. It didn't feel that way to me. And I went to my sponsor, and I said, I think I must be doing something wrong. And he said, why? And I said, because when I pray, it feels like I'm just talking to the ceiling. And he said, well, if that's the way it feels for you, then your job right now is to talk to the ceiling. Just take the action. It doesn't matter if you think it's going to work or not. It just matters that you do it. And so he said, go home and ask that ceiling to keep you sober and pray, you know, pray to God. And you can think that it's stopping at the ceiling if you want to. And so I would get down on my knees, and I would pray, please keep me sober today and give me the knowledge of your will for me. And I couldn't feel it. It felt like it was just stopping right there. And I felt weird. And I did it day after day after day. And one day I can remember waking up, and I got down on my knees, and I prayed for the knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry it out. And it still felt like I was talking to the ceiling. But that day I got up and I walked into the bathroom and I started to go through this routine that I go through just about every day. And I had an experience where something that is mundane seemed different to me. And what it was, I was getting ready to take a shower. And I walk over to the shower and I sit on the side of the bathtub. And I turn on the handle that says hot and I put my hand under the water to feel the water that's coming out of the spigot. Now, I don't know about where you live, but where I live, when you first turn on the handle that says hot, the water that comes out is not hot. It's cold. And that morning, as I felt that cold water rushing over my hand, it occurred to me, does that mean I've turned on the wrong spigot? Or does that mean that the plumbing's not working? Or that the hot water tank doesn't love me? And I realized, no, that just means that that channel has been cut off for so long that there's something else in there that has to be flushed out first before the good that I desire can come to me. And my prayer life has been the exact same way. Almost never do I get off of my knees and see the results like that. More often than not, I have to sit there with that cold water rushing over my hand, remembering I've turned on the right handle and it will be hot soon. And if you're new and you don't know what we're talking about, I would just ask you this. Believe that I believe it. And come back, and I promise that if you do what we did, all of this is for you. God bless you. Yes, yes.